We're looking at the book of Ezra in the Old Testament, chapter 7, and we're going to look at the verses 1 to 28. Ezra 7. And let me start with simply verses 8 to 10 of chapter 7. Ezra arrived in Jerusalem in the fifth month of the seventh year of the king. He had begun his journey from Babylon on the first day of the first month, and he arrived in Jerusalem on the first day of the fifth month, for the gracious hand of his God was on him. For Ezra had devoted himself to the study and observance of the law of the Lord, and to teaching its decrees and laws in Israel. Many writers have had some tag of recognition for the expressions that they use, some giveaway phrase that keeps popping up in their novels. One of the trademarks of the novelist Geoffrey Archer, for example, is a favorite phrase of his: he checked his watch. She checked her watch. Comes up everywhere. You can open a Geoffrey Archer novel and identify the author by that one phrase. An earlier novelist, Neville Shute, has the phrase umpteen times: he nodded. You find it everywhere, every three or four pages: he nodded. You can do the same with certain hymn writers. Graham Kendrick likes to use expressions like the land or nation. While Timothy Dudley Smith, and we've got one of his hymns this morning, is noted for his prefix un, undivided, unavailing, unnumbered, and we will not be disappointed this morning. Bible writers have their great words. Love, as far as the Apostle John is concerned in his letters. Grace, for the Apostle Paul. They're noted for it. And here, in our study of Ezra, the Jewish leader of 25 centuries ago, the phrase that marks him out, I wonder if you spotted it, is the expression, the hand of God. An expression in use long before it ever became associated with that very dubious goal scored by the footballer Maradona against England some years ago. It was called the hand of God goal. Very unfortunate goal too. So there's the expression in verse 9 of our chapter 7, where Ezra arrives in Jerusalem on the first day of the fifth month, and I'm quoting, "For the gracious hand of his God was on him." That was probably written by Ezra. Just a few sentences back, verse 6, "The king had granted him everything he asked, for the hand of the Lord his God was on him." Again, at the end of the chapter, verse 28, last part, "Because the hand of the Lord my God was on me, I took courage." Again, chapter 8, verse 18, "Because the gracious hand of our God was on us." Chapter 8, verse 22, halfway through, "We had told the king, the gracious hand of our God is on everyone who looks to him." Again, halfway through verse 31, "The hand of our God was on us, and he protected us." And then Nehemiah, Ezra's contemporary, picks up the same phrase in his writings a bit later. Friends, this was an era of very low morale for God's ancient people, the Jews. Admittedly, the terrible days of Nebuchadnezzar, the destruction of Jerusalem, the flattening of the temple, the exiling of an entire people to Babylonia, those 70 years of oppression were well over. Many of the Jews had returned to their land owing to the lenience of their new Persian overlords. And as we learned from the previous section, chapter 6, at last the temple had been rebuilt in Jerusalem. But between chapter 6 and chapter 7, do you know, 57 years have gone by. Years with hardly a thing recorded. Not very much had been happening in Judah. The heady days of restoration were only a memory. Now the hard job of putting a nation together again was proving too much. Perhaps it was a little bit like the aftermath of the collapse of apartheid in South Africa, or the decline of communism in Europe. The excitement was over. Now the economy has to be looked after. National cynicism and pessimism here in Judah were setting in. And where was the leadership? Ah, that's the cue for Ezra to come on stage. For the first time in person in the entire book of Ezra. We haven't read about him yet, not as a person. Here he is, verse 1. After these things, do you see it there? That is, after the return from exile, the setting up once more of the temple altar and the foundations, the frustrations to the work, the finding of those missing documents of authorization, and the successful completion of the temple in 516 BC. After these things, brings us to April 458, 57 years later. There it is, verse 1. After these things, during the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, son of Seraiah, son of Azariah, son of Hilkiah, the son of Shalom, the son of Zadok, the son of Ahitub, the son of Amariah, the son of Azariah, the son of Merioth, the son of Zeharahiah, the son of Uzai, the son of Bukai, the son of Abishua, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the chief priest, this Ezra came up from Babylon. No mistaking, then, which Ezra we're talking about. I once saw David Frost interviewing the American preacher Billy Graham on television, and David Frost was saying, all these names, lists of names in the Bible, they're so boring. So-and-so begat so-and-so, and so-and-so begat so-and-so. And Billy Graham replied, I find those lists of names absolutely fascinating. And fascinating they can be if you look at it in the right way. What else then about Ezra? He had this terrific Jewish pedigree, obviously, going right back to Aaron, the priest. And then verse 6 goes on to say, Ezra came up from Babylon. He was a teacher well-versed in the law of Moses, which the Lord, the God of Israel, had given. The king had granted him everything he asked, for the hand of the Lord his God was on him. So a man under the hand of God, well versed in the scriptures, sent under high authority from Babylon at a time when everything had ground to a full stop. God's person for God's moment. Actually, the same had been true back in Babylon. In these empty, futile 57 years in Judah, there had been a lot of drama going on in Babylon, 500 miles away, notably in the city of Susa. It's all told in the Bible book of Esther. The thriller of how, as the result of a beauty contest, it's all in the Bible, one of the Jewish exiles, Esther by name, wins the position of queen and receives a message from her relation Mordecai to use her influence to head off a plot to wipe out every Jew in the region on a single day. And Esther chapter 4, verse 14 is the key to that whole book. Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Well, Ezra would have been part of that earlier scene in Babylonia. Now it's his turn, just as a little later on it would be Nehemiah's, to use his influence as the king's MC in the royal palace, which is what Nehemiah was, to do something on behalf of God's people. Now here's Ezra. What's his position? He seems to have been the Jewish-born secretary of state in Babylon for Jewish affairs under King Artaxerxes. And is he begging the king for leave of absence to travel the 500 miles and help his people in Jerusalem, or is it Artaxerxes who is ordering him to go and sort out the confusions in Judah? It appears to be both, a happy, God-given coincidence. a converging of two minds. You go, says Artaxerxes, and I'll give you a letter of authorization. Yes, of course, you must get that temple of theirs sorted out and running properly. We'll help you. Take some of the things you will need for that. Take anybody who wants to go with you, along with you. Bring in a little law and order, Ezra, when you get down to Judah. And here is the letter of authorization. And there it is recorded for us in verses 11 to 26. Anybody who wanted to leave Babylonia, the place of their exile, and join those others who had already left Babylonia and gone down to Judah to live there, anybody could go. And Ezra sets off, accompanied by some 2,000 other Jews. We read about them in the next chapter, to help in the next stage of the rehabilitation of a people. Stage one, the rebuilding of the temple, recorded in the first part of the book of Ezra. That's the heart of the nation. Stage two, the arrival of Ezra and the establishing of the laws. That's what we're on about now. Stage three happened in the next book with Nehemiah coming over from Babylonia to get Jerusalem's walls rebuilt at last. The temple, the laws, the city itself. And with the bringing of law into Judah comes the vital corporate mindset, the framework, shall we call it the scaffolding that holds a nation together. God's person for God's moment. Because, end of verse 9, the gracious hand of his God was on him. For Ezra, we read, had devoted himself to the study and observance of the law of the Lord and to teaching its decrees and laws in Israel. Absolutely key verse. Here was a people that had lost touch with its founding laws. Those five massive books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, they seem to have been consigned to the archives as far as the nation was concerned. But in all those years in Babylonia, Ezra had made these scriptures the basis of his life and of his worldview. And as part of a generation that had neglected its Bible, forgotten its heritage, lost its way, Ezra came into his own as the man of the moment. One person, that can be enough. One person in the family, one member who knows the power of the Bible, that person becomes the key member of the family. I can illustrate that from my mother's side of our own family, my Auntie Doris. My mother had four sisters and one brother. And these five sisters, the third one down was Doris. And she was the Bible reader. She was the Christian. She was the one who was a student of Scripture. And she made it her business to lead the rest of the sisters and her younger brother to a faith in Jesus Christ. They all became either missionaries, full-time workers, or leaders, in one way or another. But it started with Auntie Doris. I never met her. She died before I was born. She died as a missionary in Japan. Her bones are there to this day. But Aunt Doris was the key to that whole side of the family. It's the Bible that does that. It's the Bible that turns lives round and makes them different. And it need not take many people to make that difference. Do you know, we would only need really one church in every town of our country, only one church that took and taught the scriptures seriously, and our society would become happier, more fulfilled, less self-preoccupied, more generous, more together. It's G.M. Trevelyan, the great historian. He wrote about the 17th century that the effect of the study of the Bible in this country, and I'm quoting now, upon the national character, imagination, and intelligence for nearly three centuries to come was greater than that of any literary movement in our annals or any religious movement since the coming of St. Augustine. That's what the Bible did to our country. And when you think of one person, it can be one in five, or it could be one in a million. Take Alfred the Great, the only monarch we've ever had who was called the Great. And King Alfred of the 9th century, he was the first truly Christian king of England. From the start, he was a servant king. So he remained all his life under the banner of Christ's leadership and under the Bible. When the invading heathen Danes threatened to overrun his kingdom, he resisted them militarily. And when he finally beat them, and King Guthrum, their leader, offered his surrender, Alfred, in a terrific act of Christian statesmanship, made friends with him and said, "Come on, you Danes and we Brits, we can share the country out. There's room for us all. Let's share in looking after the country." That's what he did. They became part of the English community, and he introduced Guthrum and his knights to the Christian faith. And when finally King Guthrum, his former enemy, asked to be baptized, Alfred the Great said, "Okay, and let me be your godfather." And when Alfred died in 890 AD, he left England peaceful, stable, undeniably Christian for centuries to come, the greatest king we ever had, one in a million. He put himself and his courtiers through school and Bible study. "Let's get back to school," he said to them all. "Come on, we'll put ourselves through the great fundamentals of the faith." And his own pattern for the day was 8 hours for sleep, meals and recreation, 8 hours for public duties, and 8 hours for reading, study, and prayer. He was known throughout England as the protector of the poor. He was one of the few servant kings there have ever been, Alfred the Great. It only takes one, and a kingdom can change. It only takes one, and a family can change. It only takes one, and a government department can change. It only takes one, and an area can change. William Grimshaw, we sometimes talk about among the preachers here. We love the stories of Grimshaw, the great fighting Yorkshire preacher of the middle of the 18th century at Haworth in Yorkshire. How he is changed by the message of the Bible in his own life when his own ministry was completely arid and without any profit. Then he was changed by the scriptures. And Joseph Williams, a clothier, commented on the change in Grimshaw and said it was as though God had drawn up Grimshaw's Bible to heaven and sent him down another. The congregation grew from 12 to over 1,000. A great revival was the result. Now, Ezra here is the key to the revival that God had planned for his people in Judah, who, as the contemporary prophet of that time, Malachi, described, were an apathetic lot. Apathetic about worship, miserly in their giving, grumbling in their disposition, and compromised with alien ways and mixed marriages that undermined the purity of their faith. It need take only one to turn a situation around. Look at our text again, Ezra 7, 9 and 10. "The gracious hand of his God was on him, for Ezra had devoted himself to," now what was it? Three things: the study and observance of the law of the Lord, and to teaching his decrees and laws in Israel. First, he studied the scriptures. Second, he observed them and lived them out himself as an example. And thirdly, he taught them to others. You could do that. I bet some people here are doing that. I'm quite sure that some people here will be doing that if you haven't yet started. And you don't have to be far on in the Christian life to help somebody else. I remember, you know how I sometimes get people to learn a verse of the Bible by heart in church. We do it sometimes in
church services. We learn a verse of the Bible, the reference, then the words, then the reference again, so you don't forget. Once when I was doing this, there was one woman in the congregation, Pauline by name. She was a housewife, and she did not really relish this going back to school stuff. Ah, it's like going back to school, learning a verse. Anyway, she learnt it with everybody else. The next day, a friend said to her, Pauline, I've been looking at you over the months. I know you mix with those Christian people. I would like to have what you've got. Can we talk about it? Pauline said, well, of course, any time. No, said the friend, I mean now. And Pauline felt completely trapped. What could she do? She didn't know. She'd never explained to anybody else before. She didn't know a single verse of the Bible. Yes, she did. She'd learnt one the night before. So hesitantly, she came out with Ephesians 2, 8 and 9. That's what we learnt. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it is the gift of God, not of works, lest anyone should boast. And she explained it as best she could, and that very day, her friend became a follower of Jesus Christ. God will bless and use the life that is committed and focused in this way. Look at Ezra's final comment in the chapter at the close of the king's letter. Verse 27. I like it. Praise be to the Lord, the God of our fathers, who has put it into the king's heart to bring honor to the house of the Lord in Jerusalem in this way, and who has extended his good favor to me before the king and his advisers and all the king's powerful officials. Because the hand of the Lord my God was on me, I took courage and gathered leading men from Israel to go up with me. So even in the face of the then most powerful man in the world, and those whom Ezra describes as his powerful officials, it makes no difference. If God is working through somebody, it doesn't matter whether it's one of the pharaohs of Egypt who's in command at the top, the king of Persia, the Caesar of Rome, or a modern-day tyrannical president. It doesn't matter. It doesn't actually matter who's on the throne if God has his person in place. Later in the saga, when Nehemiah has arrived to be the new governor of Judah, the walls of Jerusalem have been built, and the Jews once again feel themselves to be a nation. Ezra is called to the fore once again, this time in Nehemiah chapter 8. And it's a very vivid description. The people gather together en masse to hear the Bible. The wooden pulpit is set up high so that everybody can see the reader. And then they bring on the Bible student, and they say, come on, Ezra, and they bring him forward. Chapter 8, verse 8 of Nehemiah. They read from the book of the law of God, making it clear and giving the meaning so that the people could understand what was being read. That's the task. To make the Bible clear enough so that people can understand what's being said and taught. We can do that. You can do that. In your own community, might be a tiny community. It's the task in every generation, in every family, in every student community, in every government department. You may be just one in that, but there's something that can be done. In every business house, in every block of flats, to find that one person who can start the chain reaction of helping others to understand. Are you that person? How far are you that person? I must ask the question of myself. Are you going to be that person? One among six, as in the case of Aunt Doris. One among 25, 50, 100. One in a million, King Alfred. God uses that one, and the hand of God will be upon him or her. God's person for God's moment.